Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Ben Bolin.
I am Noel Brown.
And Noel, I have to tell you, we're exploring a very strange, somewhat dark story about one of my favorite places, one of my like bucket list places to travel.
Somewhat uncharted, dare we say.
Yes.
But, you know, slightly charted.
It is the continent with the smallest population out of all of the continents. In the entire area, there are a little bit over 1,000 people.
And that continent would be?
That continent is Europe.
Just kidding. Whoa, bait and switch. I didn't study for that one.
It's we all know, you can probably guess just from hearing that population statistic, it's Antarctica.
What lies hidden beneath the Antarctic ice?
I love it when you do the VO movie voice.
You know what it is?
What is it?
Apparently madness.
Uh-huh.
Chaos and murder most foul.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Antarctica is basically like a Cthulhu-esque Lovecraftian hellscape,
mm-hmm.
by many accounts.
Yeah, it is not made for people.
Mm-hmm. And yet somehow people hang out there.
Mm-hmm. And out of all the continents in the world, out of all the places on the planet where humans can exist for a sustained amount of time, this is an exception. And in many ways, the laws governing Antarctica are – we were talking about this off air. They're like the laws governing the moon.
It's all for the good of science.
Right.
For doing science.
So no one can – no one country can own – a piece of Antarctica as, you know, like an extension of their own sovereign territory. This place is for research. It's for environmental protection or conservation. It's not the place where humanity is going to build, you know, a stadium or a strip mall or another large city.
Yeah, as it turns out, seven countries. We've got Argentina, Australia, Britain, Chile, France, New Zealand, and Norway. They all have misshapen territorial claims on this icy hellscape. I'm probably editorializing a little bit there. I'm sure some people think it's nice. And the U.S. and Russia actually have sovereignty over their own research stations for doing the science. But none of these are officially recognized in the Antarctic Treaty, which is a thing. And some of them actually even overlap each other.
Yeah, yeah. And this – and these scientists and these stations work together because there's literally no one else there.
Right.
And – When we say sovereignty, it's interesting because it's similar to the way that an embassy would be sovereign soil,
right?
Regardless of which country or which area of the world it's located in. So there's sovereignty within these research stations and under the constraints of the Antarctic Treaty. Let's get a little bit true crime. You want to go kind of true crime?
Okay.
All right. Just – this is my elevator pitch. Mm-hmm. Let me know.
I'm listening.
If this doesn't work. All right. May 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Fellow named Rodney Marks. Smart guy. Astrophysicist. He is spending the winter at the South Pole.
Wintering in the South Pole like you do.
Yes, as you do. Very popular amongst astrophysicists. He had been vomiting blood and hyperventilating. And he had not been feeling well before this, but 24 hours of vomiting, hyperventilating, and he dies.
Mm. Are you sure you're not describing the plot of The Thing?
It's very it feels very close. At this point, we don't believe there were extraterrestrials.
Did a parasitic wolf burst forth from his remains and devour faces? No, I know that didn't happen. I'm messing with you.
Well, we weren't there.
That's true.
And it's an isolated place. It's pretty difficult, depending on the season, to know exactly what's happening, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it can also be even more difficult to transport people in and out of the place, especially during winter. So when Rodney Marks unfortunately passes away, they had to store his body for months until actually late October. And then in New Zealand, the nearest, you know, quote unquote civilized neighbor of Antarctica, they conducted an autopsy there. And this single mysterious death knell, it touched off an international incident.
Because as it turns out, after the autopsy, the case was ruled a homicide. Mm-hmm. And because of everything we said at the top of the show, all of these overlapping interests and territorial, you know,
jurisdictions,
I guess you could say. Where would you try a case like this?
Yeah, and it gets complicated. See, this astrophysicist was working on a U.S. base, mm-hmm. but was an Australian national, and now the autopsy is occurring in New Zealand. We're three countries deep, not even counting Antarctica. So if this is a homicide, where is the case tried, you know? The 1961 Antarctic Treaty says, as we have pointed out earlier, that this continent belongs to no nation. It's not – while there might be sovereignty over research bases, no country can say this whole part of this whole eastern coast or whatever is ours, or this whole shebang is ours. This means that – there's not a clear case of who would be the law around those parts.
Yeah, let me read you a little excerpt from the, I guess, abstract from the text of the treaty itself. Mm. The Antarctic Treaty, the earliest of the post-World War II arms limitation agreements, has significance both in itself and as a precedent. It demilitarized the Antarctic continent and provided for its cooperative exploration and future use. It has been cited as an example of nations exercising foresight and working in concert to prevent conflict before it develops, based on the premise that to exclude armaments is easier than to eliminate or control them once they have been introduced. The treaty served as a model in its approach and even its specific provisions for later non-armament treaties. The treaties that excluded nuclear weapons from outer space, from Latin America, and from the seabed. So this is obviously like a very specific case, and there are certain things that are not allowed, like nuclear weapons, any kind of detonation or testing of nuclear materials, or to use it as a dumping ground for any kind of nuclear waste or anything like that. But there are exceptions. Military personnel are allowed to be employed in these research facilities, of which there are numerous ones.
Yeah, it's surprising. So when we think of Antarctica, most of us will think of this vast, frozen, Lovecraftian wasteland with non-Euclidean geometry and these hidden cities. Minus the ancient alien stuff, it's a desert. And we can only really rank civilization by the amount of research stations. There are 75. And of those 75, 45 operate around the year, around the calendrical clock. However, there is a 3-month window when people can fly in and out for most of these places. And let's talk about crime. Speaking of fantastic segues, right?
Can I give you some greatest hits of some of these research stations?
Yeah.
There's just one that I just have to mention. So we have one that's run by France and Italy called Concordia. Mm-hmm. There's one by Italy alone called Mario Zucchelli. New Zealand's is called the Scott Base. And my personal favorite is Norway's, which is simply called Troll. Troll Station.
I'm in. Maybe there are trolls in Antarctica, and the idea is – if we name it this, it'll be right under their noses. No one will know. No one will question Troll Station's research, which would, of course, be polar trolls.
Clearly. But the crime.
So in the U.S., where we're recording this show and where Noel and I have lived for quite some time, if you commit a crime, a lot of the later investigation and prosecution of that crime hinges upon your location when you commit the crime. So you're either tried by a state or a federal court, and that also depends on the type of crime, right? So like a parking ticket, for instance, or let's say something a little more serious, a theft, for instance, versus a planned homicide. American courts have jurisdiction for some crimes that happen outside of the United States.
Like on a ship or something like that, the flying an American flag, a military mm-hmm. vessel, or in this case, a American-operated research facility.
Mm-hmm. And as we have sort of painted here, just in the very beginning of this investigation, Antarctica is the opposite of straightforward and cut and dry. This is very complicated. There are experts on the governance of Antarctica, one of them being Dr. Alan Hemmings. He spent two winters at the South Pole with the British Antarctic Survey. And according to Dr. Hemmings, there are no clear legal jurisdictions in Antarctica because there are, as we said earlier, there are no recognized territories. There are just all these research stations. And of the seven countries that we named that make these territorial claims, none of them are recognized by the treaty from 1961. And as Noel said, some of them overlap. The general rule for people in the U.S. is that a crime committed by a U.S. national, U.S. citizen at a U.S.-owned research facility would be prosecuted in a U.S. court. That makes sense, right? Our citizens, our area, right? Our facilities, therefore our rules, our legal system. And the same goes for the other countries that are operating this. That checks out, right? So far, that seems on the up and up.
Totally. But then Hemmings goes on to say, and I'll just read this quote, if the dead person and the alleged murderer are from different states or countries and don't recognize each other's claims, which most do not, particularly if the critical events occur away from anybody's station, like, you know, wandering snowblind in the frozen tundra of Antarctica and, you know, maybe murdering somebody with a claw hammer in the snow or something to that effect. I'm not saying I just, you know, or at a campsite is what he says. That's his example. It's way better than mine. Then it won't necessarily be clear who has jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Right. And this becomes the crux of the complication. As far as Dr. Hemmings knows, there's never been a criminal prosecution for a murder committed in Antarctica. And I'm going to go on record here on our show and say that I think there were probably murders that occurred in Antarctica over the span of human history. We know that there is violence and vice in this continent, and we just brought up a real life example. That claw hammer thing happened.
Yeah, no, the claw hammer thing actually happened, not in the way that I speculated earlier, but in 1996, there was an incident at an Australian facility where a cook in the galley attacked one of his fellow workers with the back end of a claw hammer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no one was killed. It ultimately resulted in both both guys getting stitches. And they actually ended up having to call in the FBI, which set kind of an unusual precedent here because, like we were saying earlier, typically they can deal with this stuff in-house.
Yeah, routine offenses, right, are usually – usually what happens is the person gets fired. The contract, their contract is not renewed, or their grant if they're a scientist, you know. And without that contract or without that grant, you can't go to Antarctica, you know.
That'd be a bummer.
That would be a bummer.
If that was like your thing, you know, that's how you defined yourself was I am an Antarctic galley cook.
And this visitors can also be banned.
Yeah. In this AP article, there's this fantastic line. It's just tossed off very casually, and I adore it. It says, visitors who taunt the penguins and seals, mm-hmm. remove rock samples, or break other strict environmental laws are normally handled by the station's chief scientist, who is a deputized U.S. Marshal.
A.K.A. the most interesting person to talk to. Right? They're chief scientist in Antarctica. They're also U.S. Marshal. They're like the law. You know what I mean? They're the law around these parts. To me, that's fascinating because we usually think of those two roles as being separate. They're very much separate in our country.
I just picture them all as being like Kurt Russell or Tommy Lee Jones-esque mm-hmm. figures.
And that's not the only Antarctic horror story or crime story. There are numerous ones. There's the Russian chess game. wherein someone, I guess the chess game went south, no pun intended, and someone attacked someone else with an axe.
Yeah, apparently killed them, in fact. But that happened on a Soviet facility, so it stands to reason that it was dealt with, you know, internally and through the Soviet government.
And then there's another story of a scientist who, driven mad by isolation, burned down their own station.
I can't help but think all of this stuff is just wonderful fodder for stories like John Carpenter's film The Thing, where a team of Antarctic researchers are essentially driven mad with paranoia and, you know, with the help of an invasive alien body snatcher, chest burster kind of situation. Mm-hmm. And there's even an episode of The X-Files that follows a similar path with an outbreak of a plague-like disease on a research facility and the accompanying paranoia that follows. So, you know, it's all pretty rife with potential for great storytelling for sure.
And it's something that I think can be universally recognized on some level by any human being, the psychological claustrophobia involved, right? You're in a confined space with interaction with the same people, whether or not you want it, and that leads to problems. Right now, when we're describing this, you know, we're just barely scratching the surface of the history of Antarctica, but the reason we are describing this is not just because it's a, oh golly gee, that's interesting legal problem. It's because it will become increasingly important as time goes on. For, you see, friends and neighbors, Antarctica has a secret. There's oil beneath the ice. I know I did that like we're going to introduce something. Like there's going to be a bum bum kind of signal.
We've already used that sound effect, though,
right?
So we can just reuse that one.
We'll lean on our super producer. Give us a cool sound cue here. Perfect. Okay, so it turns out that Antarctica has rich oil reserves, and they are rife for future exploration, which means that it is pretty much certain that in the near to mid future, more and more organizations, whether they are countries or whether they are private companies working with a country, are going to attempt to tap those oil reserves, which means that more and more people are going to be living on this continent, and they're going to be people from all around the world. Australians, people from the United States, people from China, people from, like, name a country.
Zimbabwe?
Yeah, sure, yes.
Can we just fill some time by naming more countries?
Sure. I can name some countries with you. Let's see. There's also – wait, we're not really doing
No, we're
this.
Not really doing
Oh, okay,
this.
Okay,
no,
good.
That's a very – that would be very cheap.
So right now we are, as a species, at sort of a Wild West stage in the legal story of Antarctica. In 2003, a professor named W. Michael Siegenish said, we've got to figure something out. We need to have the countries, the nations that are active in Antarctica, establish a unified criminal code. Let's all get on the same page, right? Currently, according to Siegenish, one cannot easily determine whether an action is a criminal act because of the various countries involved and multiple bases for jurisdiction. This is an intolerable situation for a criminal defendant and violates any reasonable concept of due process, which is an interesting way to look at it because not all crimes are prosecuted the same way or carry the same consequences from one country to the next.
You know what this reminds me of?
What's that?
That story we did on our other podcast, Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, about the Zone of Death in Yellowstone Park. There's this like small area, this sort of like a triangle, I guess, where there's no legal jurisdiction, or it's like difficult to determine where to pull jurors from
right.
for a case, a crime that was committed there. And a researcher by the name of Cult kind of pointed this out and wrote a paper about it, about how, you know, how to commit the perfect crime mm-hmm. In Yellowstone.
After, in his defense, he only published this paper after he had contacted numerous authorities and said, hey, can we fix this?
Yeah.
Because I don't want to, you know, we have actually had correspondence with the good Dr. Cult right. and we assure you he's a good guy. He doesn't want people to commit crimes.
No. It wasn't like a tutorial, like a how-to guide. It was just literally pointing to a problem, which is very similar to what we're seeing with Antarctica, where we need some kind of consensus, some kind of, you know, multi-nation, you know, panel, I guess, that can address crimes committed on the continent rather than limiting them specifically to the research bases proper. Because like I said, what happens if you just, you know, go off the reservation and wander, you know, in a fit of madness and, you know, commit some sort of horrible crime? What happens then if you're just like out in the wild?
Right. What if there's a situation where there are multiple assailants or multiple homicides, and now we're looking at a case where we could quite easily look at a case where, God forbid, there was a series of murders, right? And multiple murderers and multiple murder victims, and they're all from different countries. How do you even begin to unpack that? How do you begin to organize that bowl of spaghetti, that bowl of cold spaghetti? Because I'm doing weather references because we're talking about Antarctica.
Well, I think we should wrap up with, you know, the ultimate determination of what happened with our astrophysicist friend, mm-hmm. Rodney Marks. It was determined that he most likely drank a bad batch of liquor, because that's another thing. You know, when you're bored and you're kind of marooned and like siloed up in these close quarters, there's going to be some drinking going on. And, you know, maybe folks are brewing their own home brew. And I know that, you know, when you make like White Lightning or, you know, any kind of, you know, home brewed liquor, there is the potential for poisoning yourself if you don't do it right. And his autopsy showed that he had lethal traces of methanol, which is, you know, points to that very thing.
Yeah, it's a tragedy any way you look at it. And everything we've touched upon in this episode is making me think of all the other strange stuff we can explore about Antarctica, including the Nazi proposal to create the territory of New Schwabia, which is a story for another day. You know what I want to know? Let us know if you've been to Antarctica. We're automatically envious. We want to hear of your adventures.
I don't know, dude. I don't think I want to go.
You don't want to go?
I don't think so.
I'll go and I will FaceTime you.
I don't want to get snow murder madness.
I will FaceTime you while I am in the grips of snow murder madness, dangerously psychotic, right?
I'll try and talk you down, dude, but I can't guarantee I'll be successful.
I kind of, just based on our friendship, I kind of feel like you might end up accidentally enabling me.
Okay, well then just call somebody else.
What?
All right, you can call me.
And you can contact us directly. You might be thinking, Ben, Noel, I have been to Antarctica. I have a story about the history of it that is not just fascinating, it's also, wait for it, ridiculous. We would love to hear from you. You can write to us directly. We are ridiculous@howstuffworks.com.
And, you know, we're on all the usual social media channels, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and never Pinterest, though. Never Pinterest. I'm not anti-Pinterest. I don't understand it.
Right. Yeah, it's, you know.
Is it like a vision board?
It's like a vision board. And you and I already have one of those.
Yeah, it's up on the wall here in the podcast studio.
It's great. We should send some pictures out. So we are off. I'm going to plan my descent into Antarctic madness. And Noel, thank you in advance for saving my life. But we will be back very soon with more ridiculous history.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Goodbye.
Bye.